Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking, why do we love talking animals? Don't worry, we haven't gone mad and started conversing with our pets. We're talking silver screen here, where adventures with furry, feathered and occasionally ferocious friends seem to be a hit in 2016. Today's show is all about cinema trends so far this year. And while animal adventures make up 6 of the 12 best-selling movies since January, there's another beast that's been having a tougher time, the sequel. I'll be in the studio with an army of film experts to explain why we're sick of things returning, striking back, or getting lost in New York, and why any Roman numerals at the end of the titles are causing cinema goers to stay at home. And that army consists of film critics Karen Krasanovich and Tim Robey, and executive director of the Rio Cinema here in London, Oliver Meek. Lights down and popcorn at the ready as we head to the cinema on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Karen, Tim, Oliver, welcome to the programme. We set it up there. We teed it up nicely. We've got two binary choices to concern ourselves with over the next 25 minutes or so. Talking animals, what do we think? What do we think so far? And sequels. So let's tackle sequels first. Has it been a good year for sequels? We're kind of alluding to the fact that they've been struggling. They've been kind of like limping along this summer. It's not like the weather's been that good. So what's been going on? Tim, I'll start with you.
Yeah, it sort of feels like luck of the draw sometimes. And this summer is definitely a short straw kind of summer in terms of how good the sequels have been. The sequels, the remakes, the reboots, the sequel to the reboot, the remake. I mean, people
it gets
just
very confusing.
It gets confusing, yeah. And a little bit boring unless the films really hit the mark. And I feel as though they've basically played it very safe. So we're talking about films like, you know, one of the better ones, really, Star Trek Beyond, still playing it very safe. Takes no risks with the major characters and kind of tells a story that one of the old TV episodes might have done in an hour and kind of stretches it over to, you know, completely fine, not exactly reinventing the formula. And then you're also looking at very, very unnecessary sequels. Do we need Now You See Me 2? A sequel to the barely even remembered kind of magician,
this is a magician
heist movie.
Thing, right, yeah.
The magician thing, and they kind of throw in some extra cast members. Daniel Radcliffe's in it this time, but really to little avail, and it's just even more annoying than before. And then there's the real disappointments. For me, Jason Bourne is very disappointing. Mm. It doesn't justify its existence well enough.
Paul Greengrass back at the helm of this one. Sort of surprised, actually.
That, with
you
Matt
sort of
Damon.
Think if he was going to come back, it was going to be a good movie. It was going to be an exciting thing. Karen Krasanovich is rolling
it.
Her eyes.
I mean,
well.
I really love Jason Bourne, so I'll have your ticket. I love the
I'm
music,
not seeing
it
again,
the, everything. The stunt was stunts are okay. Fantastic. Anyway, I think what's interesting about this is that the genesis of the sequel has always been in question. I mean, older stars used to just eschew them completely. The studios would try to get them to do it, and they go, no. I mean, if you look, for example, Patrick Swayze didn't want to be involved in Dirty Dancing 2, et cetera. So really, the life of the sequel has been up and down anyway, historically speaking. It's only been occasionally, maybe, I don't know, Men in Black or something like that, where they suddenly saw, wow, we can improve it. Very rarely is the sequel better than the original. Occasionally it is. And then, okay, because I did my thesis on this, actually. This was about 2009, so if you pumped money into a franchise, you ended up making more money. Now, that is not the case any longer. And the reason is, well, there's several reasons, and that's why Oliver is going to be talking about, you know, the impact of all this, that they're not taking risks anymore. Studios can't afford to take risks in the way they did. It's just too much. But as I always say, they're not in the business of making movies. They're in the business of making money.
And we feel like we have at least consensus around the table, it seems like, on the idea that there aren't enough exciting films or enough exciting sequels. It's one thing to make a film that's a bit like another film with a similar sort of title, but for that film to be quite boring, like the Star Trek one perhaps, what's going on with that? I'll bring you in a minute, Oliver, for the kind of repercussions for running a cinema. But Tim, there's no excuse for that, surely. With a good cast, with great directors, surely you can write a decent story. What's going on?
I mean, the big question I want to ask is, where is this year's Mad Max Fury Road?
Because what a wonderful film.
There is a sequel that absolutely rocked everyone's socks off. Just incredible. Like, one of the best films of last year.
But 20-year genesis for that film.
I know, right. So they'd thought it through. And they'd decided to make it in a very, very difficult and hazardous, old-fashioned manner with a lot of practical stunts and effects, sort of 80% of the effects allegedly shot, you know, on location in the Namib Desert. And what a film it was. And there is just nothing that can hold a candle to it this summer. There's not even, I mean, if you look at the box office, that film obviously did brilliantly. Last summer, also, we had Jurassic World, which I think is quite a shoddy film, but did absolute gangbusters. It made so much money. It made twice the amount of money that any of this summer's films are making, including Finding Dory so far. So something's gone wrong in the system. They can't even market a kind of like mediocre film and make it take money. They're failing. And there is no Mad Max Fury Road. There is no kind of creativity being pumped through that will really get everyone excited and want to go back into the cinemas again.
I wonder if we see a difference between theatrical and DVD, you know, or home release as well. Because there is something sometimes, I don't know, with a man that runs a cinema and two film critics around the table, remember I shouldn't say this, there is sometimes that cosy realisation that you're enjoying a very mediocre film.
Yeah, well, no.
There's nothing wrong with that
it's
at home,
a guilty
but when you're
pleasure.
when you're paying £10 yeah. or 15 more like in London often yeah. to go and see a film, you really don't want that, do you?
Well, right? Well, I mean, we were talking in the green room, and we didn't leave our good game in the green room, by the way, we've got it here.
I missed all that stuff. We need hidden microphones.
Hope not. I hate the hidden cameras in the bathroom. I was watching Lawrence of Arabia on my phone once. I thought, what am I doing? But Oliver was talking about how the popularity of Tarkovsky and the fact that Tarkovsky's a big screen event.
Yeah.
And I think it's becoming where viewing a film, because people do it all the time. People are always talking about seeing films, whether they're pirating them, downloading them, DVD, whatever. They're always talking about it. So it's there. The content is watched, is consumed, but how it's done, and I think it's now, we are now having to treat films in the cinema as we would opera and theater. And I think that we need to start understanding it is an event. And also, we're talking about the popularity of all the talking animals. I hope I'm not jumping ahead. Is that there are people who have children who it's very expensive to go to the cinema on your own unless you take your kids. So there are lots of obstacles to trying to return to the cinema of my youth, which was the big screen. You watch it there, and then it's
cheap,
gone.
Cheerful. There it is, and it's yeah, yeah it's a
and every thing. Week everybody would go.
And we have promised our audience the voice of Oliver Meek. Who runs the Rio Cinema in Dalston in London. And he's been hiding his light under a bushel. Let's bring him in. Oliver, welcome to the programme. He's been sort of putting up his hand to interrupt two noble film critics. What are the repercussions for running a cinema? I mean, also, do you agree with Karen and Tim here that actually it's not a classic summer for the blockbuster? Does that give you ability to programme your cinema in a different way, put on some films that people might not have heard of, or some more indie fare?
Well, it's actually not been a classic summer for the indie film either. Yeah. And unfortunately, two major sporting events this summer, so the European Championships and then coming up with the Olympics, means that distributors tend to play it very safe. So as we've talked about already, they go for very, very unadventurous choices. So lots of sequels, lots of kids' films. So it's been very difficult.
So do they come out then in the autumn, in the winter, or do they sort of disappear? What happens? Because well, presumably there's a good
they'll
time
save
for these
them.
Things.
Yeah. They'll save them for later when they think they may have a better chance. So I think a lot of distributors think, well, audience numbers are going to be hugely down over the summer because of the weather, because of sporting events. So we'll just, you know, look at the bigger blockbusters, which we don't really tend to show at our cinema. We have much more of a kind of independent angle.
It's one of those funny things, I suppose. What do you think is the sort of emblematic film of this safe, slightly cosy summer then? If you can, presumably your distributors won't mind listening to the, you tell it like it is.
Oh, I wouldn't want to call anyone out.
I reckon it's Finding Dory, you know, which is a very respectable film. It's absolutely fine. But it finds the sweet spot between being a sequel to a beloved film that everyone was always going to go back in and see and a talking animal film. Yeah. So it's kind of got everything going for it, and it's Pixar. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely not, you know, it's not like peak Pixar, is it? It's Pixar kind of like doing its job quite well.
It's Memento for kids.
Yeah, right, there we go. Yeah. It is like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man, put
Memento
that on the poster.
Oh, totally, yeah.
That's
Oliver
amazing.
Meek goes around scribbling his own quotes on posters all over his cinema.
He's wasted in that job.
That's
he needs
good,
to be
it?
Doing our job here.
And it's one of those things, I mean, we talked about this when you gave us a tour of the Rio, Oliver, that there's nothing like that buzz when you put on a film, you've kind of chosen it, you've programmed it, you go in there, and the auditorium's full, people are, and there's a hush that descends over the auditorium as the lights go down. Obviously, that's still the holy grail for you as a feeling and as someone that runs a cinema. What's the next film you're kind of betting on for that feeling when you know you love your job and you know the audience love you doing your job well, I wonder?
Well, we've got Giulietta coming out the end of
August.
The new Almodovar film, which I'm a big fan of Almodovar's. Mm-hmm. The last couple have been disappointing, but I think this is a return to form. It's kind of the best thing since Volver, I think. And these films always come out on the August bank holiday. They've always have done. And when I first started working in a cinema, it was an August bank holiday and All About My Mother came out. So it's significant to me. But I think it's a great film. So hopefully I think that'll be the first film, the indie film of the summer, that will really bring audiences in.
And there's a bit of a strange idea as well. You kind of feel like warm weather and cinema, we talked about this as well, warm weather and cinema don't go hand in hand. But actually, strangely, when you're watching something foreign language, especially something Spanish, it's quite nice to walk out of a balmy London evening in Dalston and pretend you're somewhere else.
Yeah, there is
definitely an element of that. A bit like walking out of the cinema with the swagger of James Bond or Han Solo. There is a bit of kind of going, God, I want to envelop myself in this world. Everyone kind of wisecracks when they walk out of a Woody Allen movie, don't they? Everyone wishes they were walking down Fifth Avenue.
Yes, I know what you mean. I do the same thing.
There is.
That's the thing about Julieta, though. It's so gorgeous that with all due respect to the London summer, there are not many moments in the London summer as beautiful as what you're going to get to see in that film.
I
was too busy watching the use of red in that film. It's like red.
Amazing palette of colours. Yeah,
really cool.
I'd like to ask Olive, actually, how well Love and Friendship did the Whit Stillman film, because that's one of the very few kind of small scale films over the summer that I've actually been able to say, if someone's asked me what should I see, I've said to them, well, there's Whit Stillman's Jane Austen film, which I found hilarious. How well has it done? Did you program it? And
we did program it. It did okay. Mm-hmm. It tends, those kind of lit flicks, as I call them, tend to appeal to a slightly older audience, and actually the Rio has a really young audience in general, so it didn't do as well as it did at some other independent cinemas. But it was a really interesting film, so it was good to program something a little bit different. And I think going back to what we were saying before, you know, as far as we're concerned as exhibitors, what we want is originality. The thing that gets people off the sofa and into the cinema is an event, is something they don't feel will be the same experience at home or on their computer or on their phone with that buzz. So that's really what's been disappointing about the summer, is there's been a bit of a lack of originality so far.
And is that a genre of film? Is that something to do with the press and the buzz and the good feeling around a film? Is it the return of a much-loved director or star? What gives it that X factor, Oliver, for you as a programmer, when you can rub your hands together and kind of think, yeah, this is, something's going to happen around this? Yeah.
To be honest, I don't really know.
It's kind of a magic formula, isn't it?
Well, I'd move to Hollywood and I'd produce films and you know, have a very big house, and if we could predict it, if we could tap into exactly what it is.
Do you and Karen, I wonder, Tim, if you guys have that feeling when you are, there's a kind of a groundswell of critical opinion, you chat to people outside a screening, God, that was amazing, or whether you kind of, you hide your critical light under a bushel until publication day, and you're not, there isn't necessarily a critical, you know, you suddenly find that your colleagues across the newspapers and magazines, websites, feel the same as you do.
The most that you ever feel that, I don't know about Karen, is for me at film festivals, you feel a real kind of groundswell.
It's a collegiate
feeling there.
And certainly
this year's Cannes Film Festival was a really excellent one. There were so many good films, mostly foreign language films, which we will get to see down the line. But we were coming out of film after film thinking, wow, that was another great one. Goodness, Cannes is absolutely knocking it out of the park this year. And then you come back to London and you're like faced with, you know, Batman versus Superman, X-Men Apocalypse, and these other very disappointing superhero movies that have really crashed and burned the summer, with the lone exception really of Captain America Civil War. It's the only one that people have really kind of decided, yeah, that's good enough. That one was good enough.
And is that good? Was that good?
That's definitely the best of the crop, and it's probably the
best. That's funny though, it doesn't always work that way.
It really doesn't.
The best film wins.
Kind of thing.
But that one has done really well. I mean, the other thing, you mentioned star names and big director names. It's been a terrible summer for the big names, because look at Spielberg's had a terrible time with the BFG. I think they really overestimated
it's big in Ireland.
The appeal of that film in America, the appeal of that story in America. And look at George Clooney, Money Monster was a big flop. Look at Johnny Depp, the second Alice in Wonderland film was a disaster for him. Well, it's really not panned out for them.
Well, you know, some studios are actually asking critics to come in and look at their films before they release them, which I think is interesting. Not that we're filmmakers, but we certainly are critical. And I think that certainly helps. As far as judging films, I'm so excited when I come out of a film, I'm like, wow, because I love the medium. I love it. And then I got to calm down for a week, and then I got to think about it.
I wonder if there is that thing where you walk out of a screening and people kind of will mutter something to each other, but they, you don't want to go. You can't be too gung ho. You can't be too, you know, gung ho about it.
Yeah, I am because I'm American. But yeah,
do you know what I mean? Because there is a sort of quiet appreciation thing that happens, yeah. And you don't want to. You want to keep your powder dry for your review. You don't necessarily want to. I was going to say something rude.
I should. Don't want to like.
I was going to say.
Does this start with an S?
I had to see Star Trek Beyond at very short notice at a public screening. It was kind of come to see it for free type screening in Leicester Square, surrounded by kind of fans. Mm. And then I had to dash off and do my review really quickly. All I heard, and I didn't really want to engage, but all I just heard was a couple of guys coming out at the end, kind of going, "Well, you know, it was okay." It wasn't great, though, was it? And that was literally it. And I kind of scuffled
that's
off.
That's fans, and
that was
free.
Absolutely my feeling as well. Okay.
The same thing in Warcraft. They were kind of like, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think Beyond was fine, but, you know, fine is as good as you're going to get.
We are all three of us around this, all four of us around this table going,
But
anyway, but maybe Talking Animals will save us. I promised our listeners at the top of the show that we were going to talk about Talking Animals. And while most sequels have been cowering in the shadows of their predecessors, there's one that seems to have been a hit, and that's Disney Pixar's Finding Dory. Not according to Tim Robey, though. The animated family film about everyone's favourite forgetful fish that follows 2003's Finding Nemo. But this seems to be part of a different trend. Recently, it was reported that so far this year at the US box office, 6 of the 12 top selling films have featured talking animals. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaks to Ben Fritz, reporter for the Wall Street Journal, to find out why we're turning to fuzzier and scalier friends for a night out at the movies.
Hi, Dory!
Ahoy there! Do you want to play hide and seek?
Okay.
We'll hide, and you count and come find us.
Okay, Daddy.
No.
If you just add up Finding Dory, The Jungle Book, Zootopia, Kung Fu Panda 3, and The Secret Life of Pets, they've grossed more than $3.3 billion at the box office so far, which is pretty tremendous for five films.
It is tremendous. I mean, I know we always had, you know, films with talking animals, but this year it's been quite an exception. It's quite a trend, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's kind of funny when these trends pop up, but it does seem like, you know, at a box office where it's hard to get people to come out to the movie theaters anymore, and there's sort of these big superhero sequels that... I think Talking Animals kind of ends up being a symbol to people that it's a family-friendly film, and that despite all the problems Hollywood is having, family-friendly films are a type of movie that work, and the type of movie that people still love to see when they can all go together.
And, you know, I was reading, you wrote about that for the Wall Street Journal as well. One of the reasons, actually, because those films, they work not only in the U.S., but very much internationally as well, because, you know, they're not specific to a certain country, for example.
Right, so they're funny, and they're one of the few types of comedies that can work very well around the world that doesn't rely on any culturally specific information or context, because it doesn't have to do with human beings who live in America or live in France or live Russia or anywhere in particular. These are animals, and so it's all kind of made up, and it's much easier for people around the world to relate to it without having to know anything specific and thus define the comedy in it, I think.
For example, in films like Zootopia and The Secret Life of Pets, I believe they are, you know, original films. Perhaps we're going to see, we'd definitely see Zootopia 2 and Secret Life of Pets sequels as well, don't you think?
Sure. Yes, I think we absolutely will. But that also goes to show, I think, family-friendly animation is one of the few areas in which you see original ideas still working and being very successful at the box office, whereas in live action, you almost never see an original film being this successful.
And critics love them as well.
Yes, yeah, these movies have pretty much all gotten very good to great reviews. Finding Dory is, I believe, the best reviewed movie of the year. And Zootopia got great reviews. The Jungle Book got great reviews. Secret Life of Pets and Kung Fu Panda 3 got good reviews. These are not movies that are like just for little kids and adults can't stand them. Quite the contrary.
And we're talking here, of course, about money, box office. Those are very easy films, you know, for marketing, you know. Perhaps not only the box office, but you can very easily make products of the animals in Zootopia, for example, or any of those films.
That's right. They're easy to market. They're easy to turn into merchandise, which sells and makes more money for the companies. And while they sometimes have stars do the voices, stars are not, it's not the stars' faces. So they don't have to pay these big movie stars nearly as much to do it because it doesn't take them very much time.
And finally, you know, just kind of a funny question. I mean, it seems that humans are not very much on trend in the box office. You see flops like Alice Through the Looking Glass, the BFG. What animals can do that humans can't? And why are we so interested in them?
Well, you know, again, I think there's something culturally specific about relating to a human being in a particular situation that's tougher for people. It takes a lot more time to understand what that film is and know whether it's relevant to you. But I think if you were a little kid, you were just seeing a movie about animals is really fun, and you can kind of get it immediately. And then for adults, especially if it's a good movie like these are, it feels safe and family-friendly. You're happy to go with your kids. It's become tough to make sort of live-action movies, especially featuring adults, that people feel safe and relatable going to. And when people go to the box office these days, they tend to make really safe choices.
And finally, Ben, sorry, I'm going to put you on the spot. What has been your favorite of the bunch of those talking animals films this year?
I guess I would have to say I think what's most interesting is The Jungle Book, because there was a little bit of live action with where the actual main character Mowgli is merged with the animals, and the animals are done photorealistically. It's not a cartoon, so it stands out as being a little bit different, and I think it was a little bit riskier to make. So its success has been perhaps the most impressive of all these films. I wanna be like you. I wanna walk like you, talk like you too. You'll see it's true. Someone like me
can learn to be like someone like you. Okay, well, that was Ben Fritz from the Wall Street Journal. He was talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco there about talking animals, the trends therein. I'm glad he mentioned The Secret Life of Pets. I haven't seen this film. I have a feeling I'm going to see it on DVD. My wife calls it Pets After Dark, as if they get up to different things when you're asleep. I don't know what that is. That's a sort of an amusing misreading of the title. Anyway, enough about my life. so we were talking there about safe choices, that you can animate creatures and put words and ideas and epigrammatical phrases in their mouth, and people are fine with that but don't like it when humans do it. What on earth's going on, Tim, with that?
I wonder if it's something to do with the kind of human attractions this summer just being so off-putting. Mm. So many of the films have been really kind of grim and kind of dark and a bit exhausting, you know, the Batman, Superman's, Tarzan. The Tarzan film is about kind of exploitation of slaves in the Congo, and it's like families don't necessarily want to go out for that stuff. So instead, you can go and see a film like Zootopia, aka Zootropolis, which actually deals with some quite interesting and sophisticated kind of political ideas, but does it in a really palatable, colourful, lively and engaging way. And it just has brought people in. I think that's the pick of the crop, actually. And that is not a safe film, actually. It's really quite sophisticated, that film. It's quite clever, but it's also extremely entertaining, and it kind of works on a lot of different levels.
And that seems to be what we're talking about, whether it's that sort of two-speed reading of a film, I suppose, where the kids can enjoy it because there's lots of action and it's cute, and the adults can get it because there's some issues are tackled, some wit and some vigour is in the script as well, Karen. Do you sort of buy this as well? And are you slightly disappointed, I wonder, at the idea that the notion of going to the cinema is done with such safety, as Ben Fritz was talking about in our package there?
Yeah, I mean, I am. Simply because I've worked with a filmmaker who actually was one of the executive producer of Mad Max Fury Road, who was talking about the fact that the risk taking, the innovation and the creativity is being drained away from Hollywood. That's my word, draining, not his. It has to do with money. It has to do with time. If you want to have a good film, it's going to take time to get the script right. It's going to take time. Nobody locks a script anymore. Mm. Maybe Pixar does. I'm sure they probably do. Yeah, I do miss the risk-taking of Tarkovsky or any of the 70s or 80s cinema. But I think Hollywood is now they're taking a hit for playing it safe. I've seen scripts, for example, I won't give any examples, but I've seen scripts that were brilliant that when they were made, they were changed by the studio. And they
taking
were taken,
the edges off.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. I'm so close to telling you which ones they were. But it's heartbreaking because
we'll pretend
they're
we'll
good.
Switch the microphones off.
Yeah. The alphabet and the word team.
God, he read my mind, Mike. Don't do that. I'm put on my tin helmet now.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating. It's frustrating for the writers, and this is why a lot of writers have moved to television. This is where the challenging writing is going, and we need to bring them back into cinema. But I was just reading an old interview with Stanley Kubrick. He had the same problem. He said, you know, the cinema is very difficult, and it always has been.
We can end on Stanley Kubrick in 4 minutes' time, because Barry Lyndon is re-released, I think, today, is it, in cinemas?
Beautiful
in the UK,
film.
At least. Oliver, finally, programming this stuff, we mentioned when that package was playing, actually, that you had The Jungle Book on. It's an afternoon thing for you, that Finding Dory will... Finding Dory, have I got that right?
Yeah.
Finding Dory, yeah, that's right.
slightly new. It's like the Finding series.
You're basically your Dory. Just you've got short-term memory loss. No, just like, you have to be
like
reminded that you're called
constantly
Dory,
banging
not Nemo.
My face into a studio glass wall. Oliver, is that what it's like? How do you program these ones? I mean, these seem like they're family friendly. They're dead certs. You said that the Rio has quite a young skewing audience. I mean, do you mean like young families? Do you mean kids? Expecting Dory to be a hit for you guys?
Yeah, we do have lots of kind of young families in the area. Mm. And for example, Secret Life of Pets, we've got the week after next, and we'll have that 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
I'm going to take Mrs. Bound to that.
Yeah, you must. Yeah. You must see it on the big screen.
Pets After Dark.
We have the Jungle Book, and I believe we have Angry Birds today as well.
Okay.
Which is probably not. I'm not. Yeah, you like Angry Birds?
Yeah, yeah, enjoy that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, those films do quite well. We tend to pick them up later because our audience know that they'll come to the cinema.
Yeah.
And they're not so eager to rush to go and see them. But I completely agree about Zootropolis being the pick of the bunch, one of the best films I've seen this year. And I think just those films are so much more sturdy because the filmmakers know they will be watched over and over and over again. So more time has gone into it, more effort, the humour, the observation, it's really refreshing. And actually, if you think that, you know, attention to detail was put into some of the bigger features, we'd see a lot more originality.
Well, here, that's very nice to hear from someone that runs a cinema as well, with a kind of passion for at least one of the films that we've spoken about.
Can I make
genuine passion?
One last point about Talking Animals. It's a point that Will Arnott, the comedian, made, who's the voice of a character on telly at the moment called Bojack Horseman, which is about a horse actor. And it's a very bizarre concept because the animals in this world just interact with humans as if they were human. But he said, you know, it's partly about his career and his failures over his Hollywood career. And if it was him, if it was just this kind of white, straight, middle-aged guy doing it, he'd worry that people wouldn't care. But because he's turned the character into a horse, somehow it universalizes it. And I think that's what a lot of these talking animal films do. They enable kind of identity politics to be kind of solved in a way, because you can see whatever you want to in these characters.
We're right back to Mr. Ed. okay, finally, also, quick round the table. Barry Lyndon, I think, was in cinemas last Friday. So we've got a week maybe of seeing that on the big screen. Where do we rank it? I mean, it's one of my favourite films ever. It's my favourite Kubrick film. Let's go around the table. Oliver, is it going to be appearing at the Rio?
Yeah, we'll have it on a Sunday afternoon, I'm sure.
There we are. I'll see you there. That's okay, great. Beautiful. And that must be one of those ones where you get a little the frisson, the prickle of excitement.
Yeah.
Seeing the dust particles dancing around.
And Kubrick films are always popular, actually. Every time we show one, they always get an audience, which is really reassuring.
Yeah. Karen?
Yeah. Well, they just don't make films like that anymore. And that you go and you just think, this is what is cinematic.
Too long, but not long enough.
And also, there's a great rearing horse scene, which I enjoy.
Indeed.
1975, Best Picture, Jaws, Barry Lyndon, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Nashville, Dog Day Afternoon.
Wow.
Best year ever. Mm. Barry Lyndon's the best of the five. Mm. I mean, it's just a wonderful year. And yeah, that film is easily in my top 20 of all time.
Yeah, beautiful stuff. Well, listen, my thanks to Tim Robey, to Karen Krasanovic, and to Oliver Meek. It's been nice chewing the fat and wondering whither the sequel. We'll all be marching off to see Zootopia by the sounds of it. And of course, Barry Lyndon. Also, thanks very much to producer Holly behind the glass, imagining that she's in a sort of, I don't think she's running a cinema herself and back there. So thanks to all of us, and most of all to you for listening. From me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.